Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mona Montgomery with this evening's edition of The Hula Hoax. There were no gas chambers. There was no pure Jew fat soap. There were no Jew skin lampshades. And there were no Mengelian experiments. What there were concentration camps, because Hitler had decided that the Jewish Bolsheviks, who were in the process in Russia of crucifying, torturing, and killing 65 million white Christian Russians, needed to be put in cages.
Regarding the movie The Passion, Mel Gibson did win a great moral victory. He had been pressured by the Jews under threat of homicide against himself and his family that he should not put in the line, "Let his blood be on our heads and on the heads of our children." That line takes place in the scripture when Pontius Pilate comes out with Jesus and says, "I don't want to execute this man, he's done no wrong." And the Jews say, "Crucify him, crucify him." And then Pontius Pilate washes his hands and says, "I wash my hands of this man's blood, he's done no wrong." Then the Jews yell from the crowd, "Let his blood be on our heads and on the heads of our children." As you know by now, Mel Gibson was under threat of being killed or assassinated, and his family was also threatened with assassination if he didn't take those important lines out of his movie. But he didn't. They didn't show up in the subtitles, but you could hear in the back from the crowd, the Jewish crowd yelling in Aramaic, "Let his blood be on our heads and on the heads of our children." So that was a big moral victory for Mel. That line did show up in the movie, but it didn't show up in the subtitle, so you had to be a little bit of a Bible scholar to know where it went. And sure enough, in the crowd, you did hear, you know, and you knew that that was the line, "Let his blood be on us and on the heads of our children." When Pontius Pilate, for about the fourth time, said, "I will not crucify this man, I wash my hands of it, I want nothing to do with it." So now in two of the scriptures, it says that Jesus turned him over to them. And the indication is very clear that he means Pontius Pilate turned Jesus over to the Jews. That's in John and I think Matthew. In Luke says that Pontius Pilate wrote up the order for the crucifixion. And I forgot what the other one, Mark, says. But the point is, Mel Gibson went way easy on the Jews. According to my understanding of this Bible, it was the Jews who crucified Jesus, not the Roman soldiers. But it's put in the movie that the Roman soldiers did the actual crucifixion. Personally, I'm leaning toward the Herodian soldiers, who would have been Jews, and I have a lot of reasons for that. Most notably, when they're mocking Christ as making himself out to be the king of the Jews, which he never did, of course. All of the evidence was completely false. Most notably, the fact that they said he was teaching them not to pay taxes, when in fact, Jesus was very clear that you should render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and render unto God that which is God's. But anyway, when they're mocking Jesus, they say, "Oh, hail to the King of the Jews, you certainly aren't a fit leader for our brotherhood." Well, what brotherhood would the Roman soldiers be talking about? That would clearly be a remark made by Jews. Jesus said in the movie, when Pontius Pilate was talking to him, he said, "The guilt is with the people who turned me in. You're not doing anything that you're not authorized to do. The guilt is with the people who turned me into you." So that's out of the horse's mouth right there. The guilt is on the heads of the people who took sadistic pleasure in crucifying an innocent man. And we still have people like that today, that's for sure. And these people are evil and should be seen as evil. That's the horror of this story. The Jews took great delight in stalking Jesus throughout his entire ministry, threatening him with assassination, causing him to live a life of terror, so that he himself said, even the little rabbit has a home, but has a hole to crawl into, but there's no pillow for the Son of Man to lay his head on. They made his life a living hell, and finally they did succeed in silencing the voice of truth and reason. That's the cruelty here. In John 19:11, Jesus says to Pontius Pilate, "Thou couldst have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin." Now that's direct from the horse's mouth. It was the Jews who had the greater sin, not Pontius Pilate, and not the Roman guards, if indeed it was Roman guards who crucified Jesus. Clearly, according to Jesus himself, the greater sin was that of those who delivered Jesus unto Pontius Pilate. John 19:11. I don't think that St. Paul promoted Christianity by any means. I think St. Paul was a devil. I think that he persecuted the Christians by throwing them to the lions, and then when he failed, he became the head of the church and he perverted Christianity, which was a simple religion based on the idea that God is love and that you will succeed in life better if you'll treat people honestly and fairly. A simple doctrine, but a doctrine that the Jews had never come close to achieving. So what St. Paul did was he said, "Oh, don't listen to this silly nonsense. It's not about, it's not about being a nice guy. Our good acts are like filthy rags before God's sight. What you have to do is accept that Jesus is the ultimate sacrifice, that God is a demon from hell who must have sacrifices. He needs to have animals taken to an altar and slaughtered on the altar, and he has to have that death by torture in order to be happy, in order to feel that he's punished you for your sins. And since the animals didn't do it for him, Jesus Christ did, and isn't that wonderful?" So, in my opinion, Paul did not promote Christianity in any way at all. He promoted Judaism. He pushed it down the Christians' throats and made them believe that if they didn't accept this doctrine, they would go to hell. And then the yarmulke came off St. Paul's head, and it went on the Pope's head, and then the Pope carried on the doctrine, and if you didn't accept this atonement doctrine, you got burned at the stake. So I'm a Protestant. I was taught when I was a kid, we don't believe that stuff. That is vile stuff. I'm what's called a Johnine Christian. John was the best friend of Jesus. He taught the God is love doctrine as Jesus did, and St. Paul, according to my people, the Episcopalians, was just a kind of a mean guy that nobody pays any attention to. I blame the Jews for torturing an innocent man, intentionally putting to death an innocent man. They knew very well that he had been teaching the Jews to pay their taxes, but they offered into evidence false testimony that he was telling them not to pay taxes. Even so, Pontius Pilate realized that the testimony was perjurious, and he did not convict Jesus Christ. Then Pontius Pilate sent Jesus to the second trial under Herod, who found him not guilty by virtue of insanity. Then Jesus was tried in a third trial, again under Pontius Pilate, and again was found not guilty in spite of all of the conflicting and perjurious testimony against him. At that point, the Jews screamed for Jesus' crucifixion, and according to the book of John and a couple of the other books, Pontius Pilate turned him over to them, meaning he turned Jesus over to the Jews. It's unclear in the Bible as to whether it was the Roman soldiers or the Jewish soldiers who crucified Jesus, since some of the Gospels say that Pontius Pilate turned Jesus over to them, the Jews, and some of the Gospels say that Pontius Pilate ordered the crucifixion. We don't know who crucified Jesus, but we know that it was an intentional crime against a known innocent man, and that Jesus himself said that Pontius Pilate was not as guilty as those who turned Jesus into Pontius Pilate, because Pontius Pilate was only acting under the direction of his authority, and his authority came down from his superiors. He had to do what he had to do under the law. When the Jews threatened to create a riot in Jerusalem, if Pontius Pilate did not crucify Jesus, that put Pontius Pilate under orders from Caesar to not allow a riot to take place and to crucify Jesus. So, according to Jesus himself, Pontius Pilate was not guilty, but the people who turned him into Pontius Pilate and demanded his crucifixion were guilty. Before Christianity walks into that dark night of extinction, we need to fight. Onward, Christian soldiers. Don't let the Satanists take over. We know we're right. We know God does not lust after the howling cries of sacrificial victims. We don't have to turn into vicious, primitive monsters just because they outnumber us and just because we're too nice to get strong. We have to get strong. We have to fight back. We have to demand recognition of Jesus as God of love and a total exposure of the Jew infection that's taken over our present religion, in most notably at the Vatican Council in 1964, when the Pope decided we're going to lie to the Christian people and tell them that the Jews had nothing to do with the death of Christ. With Mel Passion's movie, it may be that a little bit of light is shining on this horrible falsehood, and Christians can now come together and agree God did not ordain this. It is wrong, and we have to make sure it doesn't happen again. The people with the solution are the white Christians. The white race has always been the most noble, the kindest, the most intelligent, the most fun, and the most beautiful. And the only reason that white people embraced Christianity is because they knew intuitively that God is a God of love, that everything is all right with the world, and God's in his heaven. That, as I recall, was basically what I was taught as an Episcopalian. God is in his heaven, and all is right with the world. And from there, you conduct your business, and you have your personal relationships, and you're honest, and you're kind, and you're decent, and you prosper, and that's the way it's supposed to work. What we have to do is fight for a separation between us and the bestial races. It can be done on a racial basis, or it can be done on a religious basis. It's going to result in the same thing. Whites are going to have to separate from the non-whites where they can practice their Christianity, which is a basically live and let live religion, and have a good time in life, and don't let's get crazy about the atonement doctrine and the Catholics and the fundamentalists. Let's be normal, and that's what we're going to have to do. I think as Christians, it's much less important whether or not Jesus was a deity, which he himself said he was not, when he said, "Why callest thou me good? Why callest thou me good? There is none good save God." I don't think that's important at all, whether he was divine or not. What's important is whether we live the way he taught us to live. We need to turn Christianity into the religion that Jesus practiced, not a personality cult that worships Jesus. I like what white people have done to Christianity, and I wonder if the Ten Commandments weren't taken from the Egyptians, which probably were pretty much what we white people use now, since Akhenaten and his crowd were white, and they believed that there was one God, that God loved us all equally, not that we were equal or the same, but that God was equally available to bless us all, just as the sun equally shines on all of us. Sounds like a pretty enlightened religion, something like Hinduism, which is another religion made up by white people. So I wonder if the Ten Commandments were stolen by the Jews, along with all of the pots and pans and jewelry that they stole when they left Egypt, and that they then twisted it into a Jew religion, which would have to embrace Satanism and tribalism and fuck everybody but me, you know, yourself and your neighbor, your friends, and that then Jesus tried to keep them, you know, make them more human, and for which cause they crucified him, but that by the time Christianity got back into the hands of white people, where it belonged, it turned into the white man's religion. The Egyptians believed in Ra. Amenhotep IV, who was also called Akhenaten, believed in one god known as the sun god Ra. He used the sun as his symbol to teach that just as the sun shines equally on all of us, God blesses us all equally. It was a very white man's type of religion. It got into the hands of Jews. They turned it into one Satan god. And then it got taken out of the hands of Jews in the form of Christianity. And we know it today as being a nice person behind your white picket fence. Do not steal. Stay chaste until you're married. Have a good time in life, and you've done it right. Anybody noticed the upstep in anti-white propaganda taking place on the History Channel? I have. Today we were treated to at least 2 hours back-to-back of stories about how evil American Nazis are, and the Turner Diary was held responsible for the Oklahoma bombing. Remember? They said that Timothy McVeigh truck bombed the Oklahoma City building, the FBI building, but now Terry Nichols' lawsuit is probably going to be dismissed because they've discovered that the FBI intentionally withheld from the Timothy McVeigh trial important information that they already had bombs planted in the building. So Timothy McVeigh was framed, and he was framed on the flimsiest of evidence. The evidence against him was that he had Xeroxed copies of portions of the Turner Diaries in his truck. So now you can be executed if you are found with material that's written by anyone who believes in the white power movement, like William Pierce. Well, that's just the beginning. Then they told us that the internet was a horrible threat to world peace because white people are getting together and talking about white people's issues. So we can expect some resistance on the part of the Jews as we take back our country and drive them to Israel when they try to convince the American public that the internet needs to be censored in the interests of world peace because, alas and alack, white people with their genius IQs are starting to talk to each other on the internet. It certainly is true that every time one culture takes over another culture, they kill all of or get rid of all of the leadership of the culture that they're taking over. But in the case of the white race, we made a big mistake during the Second World War because it was our people, the white people, who were being destroyed. Our leadership was destroyed during the Second World War and before. Remember, the Jewish American, along with international Jewish Bolsheviks, took over Russia and armed with American gold the Khazarian Jews, who were basically barefoot and spitting on the ground and couldn't even hold their heads up for the photographers in 1933. They were such a people so lacking in self-respect. I mean, they really were gypsies, these Khazarian Jews to the southeast of Russia. Lenin outfitted them with uniforms of black pants and black leather jackets and gave them instructions to go around after the Tsar and Tsarina had been successfully assassinated by the Jewish Bolsheviks. These thugs, these animals, were given guns to go and exterminate the entire white race, starting with the Tsar and Tsarina, going down to all of the royals were killed, the nobility was killed, the aristocracy was killed, the professional classes were killed, the priests were killed, the churches were burned down, and this completely lopped off all of the talent in the white race. These people were white people. This aristocracy and upper class and middle class, the property owners, numbered 30 million alone. And they were just shot or sometimes crucified by being nailed to their barns by this influx of thugs who were encouraged by the international Jewish people to kill off the white race. It was clearly a race war. And we lost 65 million of our people, of our best people. Then, after we defeated Hitler, we went after another 20 million Germans under the Morgenthau Plan, which specifically stated it was going to be the purpose of the Allies to exterminate the German people. So there went 100 million middle and upper class white Christians who were killed by whom? That's the big question. We know that when you take over a country or a culture, you're supposed to exterminate the leadership. But who decided to kill off 100 million upper and middle class white Christians? Was it the white Christians who went to war and spilled their blood on the battlefield? If so, that was a big mistake, and we need to rethink that. Because now we are here in America, the white Christian majority, and we basically lack a leadership. All of our connections to Europe have been destroyed. The Jews control over 70% of our positions of power and influence. At least that's what Alan Dershowitz brags, the Harvard professor, head Jew. And they only comprise less than 2% of our population. So who is this leadership that's destroyed the leadership of the white race? And how can we get rid of them? It's our fault. It's our fault. It's the white man's fault that we were so naive and so willing to believe that all people are good, even Jews, that we allowed ourselves to be deceived into fighting against our own kind in the Second World War. And we have to undo the mess we made. We are now a race without a leadership class. We have allowed our intelligentsia to be murdered at the rate of 100 million upper class and middle class white intellectuals during World War II. And that's not counting the soldiers that died on the battlefield. It is our fault. We didn't support our leaders. We didn't listen to Hitler. We didn't put pressure on the president and the Congress to listen to the white man who was ringing the alert that the Jewish Bolsheviks, the atheists, the communists were putting a dark cloud all over the entire world and were about to institute worldwide totalitarianism. The only people that told the truth about this at that time was the Christian church that was putting pamphlets on the spreading pamphlets on the streets. That's the only way I had ever heard or been exposed to the idea that communism was the Antichrist. I picked up a pamphlet one day when I was about 8 years old. I read it, I thought about it, and I dismissed it. Who listens to little pamphlets on the street written by Christians? But the Christians knew the truth. That's why the Catholic Church supported Hitler. The Catholic Church saw that Hitler was fighting the Antichrist, the same enemy of Christians that the Catholic Church had been battling for 2,000 years. And yet, what do we see in the last few years? The Catholic Church has bowed in deference to the Jews and has apologized for supporting Hitler, which is the wrong thing to do. After the betrayal of the First World War in the form of the Balfour Declaration that exchanged a contract between England and World Jewry to give all of Palestine to the Israelis. Then we had the Second World War, in which the white man again was betrayed, as represented by Adolf Hitler, who was trying to save the white man's homelands. But from then followed the greatest intellectual betrayal this country, this world, has ever seen in all history, since they burned people at the stake in the Middle Ages for saying that the world was round instead of flat. Suddenly, if you didn't agree to these extraordinary, astonishing lies about Hitler and his men, you were considered an anti-Semite, a hater, a bigot. You were not allowed to have a job. You were put in jail in certain countries and fined in certain countries. So the brainwashing commenced, and the brainwashing continued to the extent that children are taught in our schools as part of their curriculum outrageous lies, like that the Diary of Anne Frank was a legitimate diary when it was proven in an American court to be a total hoax. the diary having been written by Anne Frank's uncle in a ballpoint pen, which hadn't been distributed until after the diary was written. That's only a little tip of the iceberg of the hoax we're talking about. We have on our Jew-controlled media the History Channel that pumps out anti-white propaganda, pro-Jewish propaganda, 24 hours a day. And if it weren't the only History Channel that we're allowed to look at, I wouldn't bother looking at it, but at least we get to see authentic photographs, and we can put together what really happened if we don't listen to the guy in the background who's lying about it. The Jews have had complete control over all of America's media, including the television, the radio, the movies, and just about anything else you can think of, definitely the newspapers. But they did not have control of the internet when 9/11 happened. And at the same time that America was attacked by the Mossad, we, the white people, and the supporting classes, had access to a way of communicating with each other. So what were the poor Jews to do but to monitor the chat rooms? And they have done this in a very oppressive manner by introducing personalities into the chat rooms that are specifically designed to stop all talk against Israel. These personalities include the good old World War II veteran, who says it's unpatriotic not to support God's chosen people, especially after so many World War II veterans died on the battlefield in the righteous cause against Hitler's Nazism. That's one type that you'll run into in the chat rooms. Another type is the British, the arrogant upper-class Briton that none of this us common people get an opportunity to meet in real life and would love to. It's sort of like meeting the king or the queen. British royalty has always been very attractive to Americans. So one of the types of chatters that the ADL plants in our chat rooms is the upper-class aristocratic Brit who does absolutely nothing except disapprove of all of us white people who don't know what we're talking about and are terribly boring for talking about Jews and things like that. And then they'll change their tone and say, oh, I just love this person or that person, and they'll support all of the other ADL members in the chat room. So there's two distinct types that you'll run into: the upper class British and the World War II veteran. A third is, of course, the Jew himself, with his arrogant New York Jewish accent. This chatter comes in male and female variations. The female is actually the more outrageous and disgusting than the male, in that she will morally instruct you as to how an American is supposed to act, most notably to support multiculturalism and fairness and equality, and never get any funny ideas about having any exclusive association with whites, because that's not the American way. And then you have the male Jew who continuously argues in support of Israel and brotherhood and explains the Israeli point of view and explains how the 14th Amendment, which gave equality to all people, means that the white man must relinquish all of his property and all of his rights because that's God's will. So you'll find these three chatters in the chat rooms who are planted by the ADL: the upper-class British man who does nothing but have contempt for all of the likes of you and me. There is the World War II veteran who will try to convince you you're being unpatriotic if you don't support Israel. And then there's the self-confessed Jew or Jewess who will promote the interests of Israel. One of the things they use, besides the contempt, is the diversionary tactic of really filthy talk. They will either attack you with filthy expletives, the likes of which you have never heard in your life before, that will really hit you in the face and rock you back on your feet, because they have really, really filthy mouths, or they will engage you in conversations about anal sex or perverted sex and try to get you addicted to perversion. And once they get you addicted to perversion, they've got your soul. We've seen a lot of nice white girls get lost that way, women who had the capacity to be intellectual, who fell under the spell of one of these perverted Jewish plants. The Jews have had complete control over all of America's media, including the television, the radio, the movies, and just about anything else you can think of, definitely the newspapers. But they did not have control of the internet when 9/11 happened. And at the same time that America was attacked by the Mossad, we, the white people and the supporting classes, had access to a way of communicating with each other. So what were the poor Jews to do but to monitor the chat rooms? And they have done this in a very oppressive manner by introducing personalities into the chat rooms that are specifically designed to stop all talk against Israel. These personalities include the good old World War II veteran, who says it's unpatriotic not to support God's chosen people, especially after so many World War II veterans died on the battlefield in the righteous cause against Hitler's Nazism. That's one type that you'll run into in the chat rooms. Another type is the British, the arrogant upper-class Briton that none of this us common people get an opportunity to meet in real life and would love to. It's sort of like meeting the king or the queen. British royalty has always been very attractive to Americans. So one of the types of chatters that the ADL plants in our chat rooms is the upper-class aristocratic Brit who does absolutely nothing except disapprove of all of us white people who don't know what we're talking about and are terribly boring for talking about Jews and things like that. And then they'll change their tone and say, oh, I just love this person or that person, and they'll support all of the other ADL members in the chat room. So there's two distinct types that you'll run into: the upper class British and the World War II veteran. A third is, of course, the Jew himself with his arrogant New York Jewish accent. This chatter comes in male and female variations. The female is actually the more outrageous and disgusting than the male, in that she will morally instruct you as to how an American is supposed to act, most notably to support multiculturalism and fairness and equality, and never get any funny ideas about having any exclusive association with whites, because that's not the American way. And then you have the male Jew who continuously argues in support of Israel and brotherhood and explains the Israeli point of view and explains how the 14th Amendment, which gave equality to all people, means that the white man must relinquish all of his property and all of his rights because that's God's will. So you'll find these three chatters in the chat rooms who are planted by the ADL. The upper-class British man who does nothing but have contempt for all of the likes of you and me. There is the World War II veteran who will try to convince you you're being unpatriotic if you don't support Israel. And then there's the self-confessed Jew or Jewess who will promote the interests of Israel. One of the things they use, besides the contempt, is the diversionary tactic of really filthy talk. They will either attack you with filthy expletives, the likes of which you have never heard in your life before, that will really hit you in the face and rock you back on your feet, because they have really, really filthy mouths. Or they will engage you in conversations about anal sex or perverted sex and try to get you addicted to perversion. And once they get you addicted to perversion, they've got your soul. We've seen a lot of nice white girls get lost that way, women who had the capacity to be intellectual, who fell under the spell of one of these perverted Jewish plants. There are two extraordinary characteristics of these ADL plants that are put in to monitor the chat rooms. Number one, they will go to any lengths to silence someone who criticizes Israel. They will use illegal boot codes to silence your voice, get you kicked out of the chat room. They will do things to your computer to make it necessary for you to go take your computer to someone to fix it, or even have to buy a new computer. In other words, they're willing to commit crimes. They also call your neighbors. They'll paper your neighborhood with posters of your face and say that you're a racist. They'll call your local police station and file false charges on you. They'll look up on the internet and see who you work for, and they'll try to get you fired. Or if you are part of a church or an organization, they'll call the secretary or the president and tell them that you need to be dismissed from the group that you're in because you're a anti-social bigot and you hate Jews and black people. That's one of their characteristics, the fact that they will attack you with everything they can think of. But the more important characteristic of these Jewish plants is that they will never talk about anything substantive. If you will notice, you will bring up a subject about politics, they will condemn you, and then they will not talk about the subject. And this is because recently there was a dialogue between one of the Holocaust revisionists who knew there were no gas chambers, who was debating with a member of the ADL on television, and a videotape was made of this debate in which clearly the white guy won. The Jew had nothing, and the historian had everything. So after that debate took place, the ADL issued orders to all of its members never to enter in to a debate with anyone about the Holocaust at all costs. There was to be no substantive discussion about the Holocaust, the gas chambers, the Jew skin lampshades, everything you've heard about, typhus. That's supposed to be a secret. You're supposed to believe these people were starved to death. The 6 million figure. None of these things are allowed to be talked about. That's the orders from the ADL from way up on top. So you will notice that all of these ADL plants in the chat rooms never talk about anything substantive regarding Israel or the Jews or the Holocaust. And that's how you know who they are. Number one, they never talk about anything. Number two, they attack you and commit crimes against you, including making false charges about you to your local police. And they come in three recognizable styles: the self-confessed obvious Jew with the Bronx accent, the upper-class Brit, and the World War II veteran. I don't think the Jews are going to be as successful in taking over the United States as they were in taking over Russia. Americans, with their history with the Founding Fathers and all of this passionate individualism, are much less controllable than Russian peasants, I think. So I believe that the Jew has taken on more than he can chew when he decided to take on America. I think the chink in their armor has definitely been pierced, at least with this passion movie, and just the revitalization of all of this patriotism and studying of the Founding Fathers. Men who you would expect never to do anything more intellectual than go to a football game are actually studying Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and all of those guys and quoting them. So I just wonder how we're going to get rid of the Jew this time. It's going to be a lot of fun. When we drive them out of America, it'll be the 91st time they've been driven out of a European country. And won't that be fun? The most important thing to do, if we're going to save our sovereignty and our society, our traditions, our values, is to arm our borders. We have to recreate our borders. Clearly, the liberals have destroyed our national sovereignty, which the Constitution mandates is to be guarded by our military, and we have no borders. But it's becoming more and more apparent that we have to recreate our borders. At this moment, uniformed Mexican soldiers are coming into our country and shooting Americans. Other uniformed people who are police, not Mexican police, but private police protecting the interests of the war, drug lords, are also coming across our borders in Texas, Arizona, and shooting people, Americans. shooting Americans and killing them. There's home invasions, there's rapes. The 7-Eleven store is just completely looted by these bandidos. And Americans are gathering on the Mexican border down at Douglas, Arizona to fight them. And they are fighting them with guns. So as this border skirmish becomes more apparent to the American people, I believe the consciousness of the American will be aroused, and he'll understand that he has to firm up our borders. We have to firm up our borders. And eventually it's going to come to the point where the president is either going to send the military down there, or we're going to develop our own military, or we will develop our own military and the government will send its military to kill us. But at least the issue is becoming seeable and visible, and it is the most important issue. In order to have our sovereign nation, we do have to have borders, and we have to have borders that are respected. Right now we have over 1 million illegal criminal aliens coming across our border every year, so we definitely are losing our sovereignty. But as I said, the issue is becoming more and more visible as there are more and more murders and shootings and things going on down there at the border, and it's getting pretty noisy down there.
As I was going over the Clark and Kerry Mountains, I met with Captain Pearl, and his money he was counting. I first produced my pistol, and then I drew my rapier. Say, stand and deliver, for I am the bold deceiver. With your ring of the true Illuminati, I call the daddy o, I call the daddy o, there's whiskey in the jar. He counted out his money, and it made him pretty handy. I put it in my pocket, and I brought it home to Jackie. She sighed, and she swore that she never would deceive me. But the devil take the women, for they never can be easy. With your ring, never do love enough. I call the daddy-o, I call the daddy-o, there's whiskey in the jar. I went into me chamber, all for to have a slumber. Hirons of golden jewels, and for sure t'was a wonder. Virginia stole me charges, and she filled them up with water. She called on Captain Pearl to make ready for the slaughter. With her ring on a new lamina, I called the daddy-o, I called the daddy-o, there's whiskey in the jar. And t'was early in the morning, before I rose to travel, up came a band of footmen, and likewise Captain Farrell. I first produced my pistol, for she stole away my rapier. But I couldn't shoot the water, so a prisoner I was taken. With my ring of a new lamina, my father the daddy-o, my father the daddy-o, there's whiskey in the jar. There's anyone can save it, tis me brothers in the army. If I could find a station in Cork or Killarney, and if they'd gonna join me, we'd go rolling in Kilkenny, and engage to treat me better than my darling broken Jenny. With your ring of a new lamina, my father and I, my father and I, there's whiskey in the jar. With your ring of a new lamina, my father and I, my father and I, there's whiskey.
It's hard to say who's a Jew and who's not a Jew, because as far as a genetic connection to the Jews that were kicked out of Israel 2,000 years ago, I doubt that there is much connection. I think they race mixed so completely in the first 500 years that they disappeared at that time. So when you're talking about Jews, you're talking about a false construct. A group of people who have decided somewhere along the way in the last 2,000 years that it would benefit them to identify themselves as Jews. The most obvious example I can think of are the Khazarian Jews, which make up today's Ashkenazi Jew, the one we think of as the more European-looking Jew, but who he's not really. He's an Asiatic Turk who has intermarried with Europeans, and he's a pretty vile individual, but he's not the short, dark, Sephardic, greasy Jew that the Palestinians look like, who would be more closely connected to ancient Israel. The Ashkenazi Jew, who started out as the Khazarian Jew, is not a Jew at all. He's a Turkish Asiatic who lived in the Khazarian Mountains to the southeast of Russia, and in 700 AD, these Asiatic Turks decided that it would benefit them if they converted to Judaism, so which they did in 700 AD. The motive at that time was to participate in the worldwide slave trade that was entirely controlled by Jews. So these Khazarian Jews became Jews, and then they intermarried with Europeans, and most of they make up today's Ashkenazi Jew, which is what you usually think of today when you think of a Jew. Well, they're not Jews. And don't forget, in Revelations, hell awaits those who say they are Jews and are not. And these are the people we're talking about. But at any rate, my analysis of the Jew is that when the internal combustion machine was invented in 1890-ish, international bankers got together and bought Jekyll Island and had meetings there and constructed a few things to ensure their control of the world. Number one, the Federal Reserve Bank. And number two, Judaism. I think it, or communism at least. I think that they sat down and said, look, we've got to get a hold of the Middle East. It's really important now because it's got all that oil. And now that we have the internal combustion machine, we can clearly see that oil is going to be the lifeblood of the next generation, or the next several, maybe next 1,000 years. So in order to get a hold of this Middle Eastern oil, which has been of no value to us, let's invent ourselves as Jews. Let's call ourselves Jews, and let's lay claim to Israel. It fits right in with the Christian religion that says that the Jews are the chosen people and are supposed to have the entire Middle East. And let's start communism and Judaism and Zionism, and let's get a hold of that Middle East. I'm trying to figure out what's been going on with Babylon over the last few hundred years. And it looks to me, by looking at the map, I should have said the Ottoman Empire, which at one time was Babylon. The Ottoman Empire increased greatly from the 1400s to the 1900s until it comprised all of Greece, Yugoslavia, the Middle Israel, Syria, Iraq, and down around even farther. That's because nobody cared about the Middle East, so the Ottoman Empire was allowed to grow at will, and it did. Then, after oil was discovered, they always knew there was oil there. After oil became important, which was in the 1800s with the invention of the internal combustion machine, you can see the Ottoman Empire suddenly becoming small, starting with Europe. So it looks like the European influence, probably the English, were gradually pushing the Ottoman Empire into itself, pushing its western border easterly, and at just about the time that it was pushed down past Israel and past Syria, Israel was created. So by studying the Ottoman Empire, I think you get an idea of who was planning this eventual takeover of the Middle East. And it looks to me like it was England from as early as 1880, and that the English Jews probably were the first ones to wake up to the idea of setting up a stepping stone in Israel so that they could take over the rest of the Middle East. We all know the story of Lawrence of Arabia, who was such a almost saint-like character who went to free the Middle East from the control of, I think it was the Ottoman Empire, I'm not sure. But then at the last minute, you'll recall, England stepped in and took over all of the area that Lawrence of Arabia had freed. So Lawrence of Arabia was just a dupe used by his home country, which was England, to set the stage for a British takeover of the Middle East. The Jews bring up the completely irrelevant argue of statehood as if it had anything whatsoever to do with their obligations to honor their agreements having to do with the partition plan. The partition plan very well delineated what land was to go to the Jew and what land was to be kept for the Palestinian, with the addendum that the Palestinians who lived in the Jewish area would be allowed to continue living there. The Jews, from day one, drove 750 Palestinians off of the Jewish side of the partition plan and then named themselves a state, which is just legal gobbledygook. What difference does it make if you're a state or not a state? Your borders are what your borders are, and those borders were delineated by the English when they turned the property over to the Israelis. There is no way the Israelis can use their statehood or lack of statehood on the part of the Palestinians to change those borders. Those borders were the original agreement. They should still be honored. The Palestinians should be given the right to return to their homes on the Israeli side of the partition plan. And if Israel is not comfortable with that contract, then Israel should be rescinded. I didn't know that Israel did not want there to be such a thing as an Israeli citizen. I didn't know that Israel considered Jews worldwide to be part of the Israeli nation. That's pretty interesting, and I think white people should follow suit. I think white people should announce a white nation based on race and get to the work of inventing some kind of a white national state to which all white people belong. I think the Jews are doing it right. I think they should not be criticized. I think they should be encouraged, and that every Jew worldwide should be encouraged to go and live in Israel. Seriously encouraged. For example, in America, we should have a rule that you cannot have dual citizenship because it's a threat to our national security. You're either loyal to America or you're not. And if you're not, you need to leave America. So I would suggest that all of the Jews worldwide move to Israel. I think there's plenty of land. Apparently, there's only about 15 million Jews in the world. That's awful small number of people. I think we have about that many in Los Angeles here. And then I think the white people should do the same thing. Instead of criticizing the Jews for not being diverse enough, let's follow their lead and find a homeland for ourselves. The Passion was an excellent movie in that it showed graphically what happens when human beings are tortured. Torture is used by many countries to this day as part of their statecraft, and it's completely obnoxious. It can't be tolerated. We have to stamp it out, starting with Israel, who tortures 400 Palestinians every month. We now know what it looked like when Rudolf Hess was tortured in that farmhouse where the Jews found him after he had escaped the verdict in the Nuremberg trials. The Jews weren't satisfied with that, and they wanted to try him again. So they found him in he'd been hiding from the Jews, and they found him in a barn. They put handcuffs on him, which they kept on him for 3 weeks. They put him on a butcher block, and they beat him almost to death, just like you saw Jesus being beaten in the Passion. They had a doctor there whose purpose was to make sure they didn't kill him. They beat him just to the point where he was about to be killed, and then the doctor said, okay, now if you continue beating him, you're going to take a corpse to trial, so stop beating him. And that's when they stopped beating Rudolf Hess. And then they made him march across the farmyard into some jail they had for him in the cold weather without any clothes on. They kept him awake for 3 days by prodding him with their rifles every time he started to fall to sleep. And finally, when he couldn't even remember what he was doing, they got him to sign a confession. And based on that confession, they executed him in Israel. Now, then they put out a propaganda machine about the propaganda movie about the Nuremberg trials, and they read this confession in a German voice, in a German accent, as if Rudolf Hess is actually confessing at the Nuremberg trials, when in fact he didn't testify at the Nuremberg trials. The confession was used in a later trial in Israel, and he didn't testify out loud at all. They simply introduced into evidence this document that they had forced him to sign by subjecting him to the very torture that you saw Jesus Christ subjected to in the movie The Passion. That is what makes that movie so valuable. We have to understand the absolute uselessness and despicableness of human torture.
It's astonishing how much damage the Allies did to the German people after the war was over, when they weren't supposed to be doing any damage at all. They completely bombed and destroyed the city of Dresden, which is that German city where all the finest china is made and all of the artists lived there. It was a totally peaceful city, the pinnacle of German society, you could call it, except for Berlin, which was also a fine, civilized part of the world. And for no reason, after the Second World War was over and hostilities had ceased, just for the fun of it, the British went out to Dresden. Yeah, they bombed Dresden after the war was over. That's what makes it a war crime. And then they drafted the Morgenthau Plan in America, which was dedicated to exterminating the German people as a race. And to this end, they put them in concentration camps, they killed millions of them through slave labor, they starved them to death, and then they introduced American GIs, more black than not. They introduced all these Negroes to force the German women to have sex with the American GIs in exchange for a little bit of food, and they introduced a huge amount of venereal disease, and the purpose was genetic. They wanted to completely destroy the genotype of this race of people who dared to think they had the right to survive as a race. They intentionally bastardized the German race. It was one of their techniques of destroying the Germans as a people. I can just imagine what kind of a tribal king the Hebrews had when they were walking over those mountains following those herds of animals like we have today. We've seen movies about these kind of tribal kings. The whole group of people are primitive. They're run by laws that are horribly cruel, and the king has to order, the king who is nothing more than he looks like a guy carrying a broom as he slogs across the desert with his animals going in front of him, because the animals know better than he does where the next water is to be found. So these guys are wearing these raggedy clothes. They don't have any shoes on their feet. And the king, who is just one of them, one of this lot, has to be in charge. And whenever anybody breaks a law, some hideous, horrible punishment is inflicted. I would hate to see this guy be deified, but I have to admit that this is the deity of the Jews. This is not what I had thought. What I had thought was that way back in primitive times, before our people could even talk, we figured out that the tiger was likely to come into our midst and eat one of us, because that was an occurrence that would occur occasionally. And so, not liking the idea of our fair-haired child being stolen, we probably had little meetings around our fires and said, let's give it old Aunt Mona instead of this cute little sissy Bubba one. And they'd take the old one they didn't love out to the where the tiger was living and tie her up, or him, and feed that one to the tiger. I always thought that was the Jewish God, that it was this tiger that you had to satisfy with some kind of flesh. And I always thought that was a pretty limited God to be praying to. It would be a huge mistake to nuke the Muslims. You don't punish people for noble behavior. You punish people for ignoble behavior.
The Iraqis are only doing what's noble. They're defending their homeland against a hostile invader who is punishing them for a crime they didn't commit. The proper thing to do is to punish the perpetrators of the crime, and that's the Jews. It was the Mossad, not the Arabs, that hit us in 9/11 and blamed it on the Arabs, just like they did during the Levant affair and just like they tried to do when they sank the USS Liberty, or attempted to. It's the Jews who are the guilty party, not the Muslims.
Thank you for listening tonight, ladies and gentlemen, to this evening's edition of The Holohoke. Next week, same time, same station.